Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm Megan Labrice, the staff writer.
And today we're going to be talking to Kristen Rupinian. You all have probably heard of her by now. She is the author of the short story Cat Person, which in late 2017 became the most downloaded story on The New Yorker for the entire year, and only one other article in the magazine's stable of articles that whole year got more clicked. So it's a story that is a little dark. It really speaks to the moment about relationships between men and women and what we expect from one another. And now she has a whole bunch of other stories that are being published in a book titled You Know You Want This.
Short stories don't go viral until now.
Yeah. Yeah, we should say that.
this is unprecedented, really, which is something we should definitely talk with her about. You Know You Want This, Cat Person and Other Stories. What a creepy, cool collection, Clay.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, Cat Person is a great story. It has a shocker of an ending if you haven't read it yet. But it's really nice to see her sort of extend beyond that story that everybody knows so well. There's a bunch of fantastical stuff, stuff that you think is fantastical and couldn't possibly be real, but she is presenting it as real. And that has already caused some critics some uncomfortable feelings, shall we say?
Yeah, let's say.
But it's just a really imaginative and vibrant collection.
Well, we can't wait to talk with her about it.
Yeah. So thanks, first of all, Kristen, for making some time for us.
Oh, thank you guys so much for talking to me.
Yeah. So Megan and I really enjoyed the collection. Really nice to see you beyond Cat Person.
Yeah, good to hear that.
Yeah. It was a particularly enthusiastic starred review from our critic.
I was very enthusiastic to get it. Let me tell you.
A couple of my favorite fragments are, this debut collection proves that success wasn't a fluke, and unsettling, memorable, and maybe perversely, very, very fun.
I loved that. So, I mean, I have that line memorized personally. You don't have to quote it to me, but it's always nice to hear it. Yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, thanks to all you guys over there.
Yeah.
I like the word unsettling best from the review, because it truly was an unsettling experience for me as your reader. And I feel a little ill-equipped having not had like years to digest it yet.
Yeah, me too. but we do our best, you know? And I do think that the visceral reaction, like for me as a reader, like the visceral reaction I have is the first most intense one, and everything else just sort of trickles out after. But yeah.
It was only in retrospect that I realized, I mean, you're selling unsettling up front. The cover is unsettling. The end papers are more unsettling. Yep. These black and white lines. If you look directly into them, you start to get queasy.
Yeah, it's a dizzying cover.
Yeah, you know what you're getting into.
Do you? I'm glad. That was something I was really concerned about. Not less when I was writing the book, because, you know, Cat Person hadn't appeared yet. But afterwards, when it was being sort of packaged and we were talking about what to highlight and what to not, it felt really important to me that people knew what they were getting into pretty quickly, because it wasn't like Cat Person and it's not for everybody. And so we tried in all of these different ways to give people signals of what was coming without beating them over the head with it. And I feel overall pretty good about how it turned out.
Well, so let's just talk for a second about Cat Person, because we've got to.
Just a second.
we can keep it to like 17 seconds if you want. But so Cat Person, in case there is anyone who doesn't know, it's about two people, Margot, who's in college, and she works at kind of an art house cinema, and Robert, who's a little bit older, and he goes into the theater to see a movie. And They have a bad date after everything starts with what seems like a lot of promise. And Margot has sex with him, even though she doesn't really want to. I'm just, you know, I read the article you wrote for The New Yorker recently about, you know, being a little surprised that it did take off so well. What, can you just talk a little bit about why you thought it took off so well, though?
Yeah, I mean, a little surprised is, you know, understatement of the year. I was shocked. But yeah, I mean, and that's another thing that, like, I am still figuring out a year later, you know, mm-hmm. going back and thinking about it. And it's funny, too, that, like, my experience of those days, it was really a weekend when everyone was talking about Catperson, like, my experience of those days was so different than everyone else's, right? Because I had turned my phone and my computer off, and I was just kind of hiding under my bed. And so everything that I know about the reaction to Catperson, I found out after it was over and sort of at a slightly more distant remove. But that said, I mean, I think having read what people said and sort of imagining myself into their shoes, I think there were a few different things going on. I think certainly, as other people have noted, the time was right, that there was a real sense, and I remember this myself very viscerally, that, like, suddenly it wasn't that, like, anything had changed. I mean, many things had changed over the past few years and were changing very quickly in terms of, you know, gender relations and Me Too and the political situation, but, like, a sense of, like, suddenly everybody was talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And there was this deep hunger to have, like, dark and more difficult conversations that was much broader than just what happened with Catperson or even what happened with Me Too, but just, like, a shift in the tenor of the kind of collective conversations we were having. And I think it's funny, too, like, in terms of short stories, I mean, I think there were a lot of people who said afterwards that, you know, it was so funny to see a short story go viral. And yeah, I mean, as someone who's read short stories my whole life, I, like, recognize that had never happened before, mm-hmm. but it does seem surprising that it hadn't, you know, that yeah. the short story as a form is so ripe for, like, the kind of instant consumption and discussion of literature that a novel just can't do for purely practical reasons, right? Because mm-hmm. everybody's going to be in a different place at a different time. And so it was cool that it was my story that happened with. And I think there are a few things that maybe, like, made the story, like, amenable to that kind of discussion. But I think, yeah, the surprise is that it hadn't happened earlier.
But there is this problem that happened after everyone read Catperson, though, of readers kind of assuming that Margot's tortured experience in that story was your experience. That must have been kind of frustrating, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. I feel less frustrated by readers who mm-hmm. did that. Then it's like it was like everybody read it and everybody talked about it kind of all at once. And then there were a bunch of think pieces that came after talking about how everyone had been talking about it. And a bunch of those think pieces were kind of critical of the, like, readers who had read it and cared about it and talked about it. And I actually felt a little bit resistant to that criticism, because I feel like it's just so classic, like, especially when young women like read and love something, that somebody wants to jump in and be like, you are reading that wrong, you have done that
right
service by caring about it so much. And that I don't feel like it was much more like, you know, and I certainly did get lots and lots of emails from people who cared about the story and wanted to share their experiences with me that were, like, positive, and but also maybe blurred those lines a little. And certainly emails from people who'd read and hated the story and really wanted to tell me what they thought about it. But yeah, I think in a lot of ways, and I said this in my essay, the assumption that I was Margot was more subtle and happened as much from critics and interviewers and people who were inviting me to speak after Catperson went viral than they were from readers. And the assumptions were not, this must have exactly happened to you, although mm-hmm. sometimes that was it. But it's like, she must be young, you know, I'm 37. She must be a student, I'm not. You know, like, those mm-hmm. kinds of things where, like, nobody is immune to it, actually. And, like, the assumption that I must have been writing approximately autobiographically and that all my stories after would, like, have that mode, like, those assumptions I actually saw less in the immediate response to Cat Person than in the things like the more like ostensibly sophisticated takes that came after.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think book journalists have something to do with that too. I mean, I have to say, you know, because we journalists, like we're wanting to know, we read a novel or a story and we want to know what's the person who wrote this really like. And so there can be a little bit of a bias among book journalists, I think, to want to know what the person is really like, or to assume that a protagonist and the writer are the same, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, having just been critical about that, like, sure, we all do that all the time. I mean, I'm doing that. You know, you imagine who the writer is and you react to that imagination. And, like, yeah, it's a natural part of reading. And, like, it was certainly, it has been very disorienting. And I think one of the reasons that it's been so disorienting for me is that it happened in such an absurdly compressed span of time, mm-hmm, you know? And for most people, you get this, like, slight, like, you know, ramping incline from like an understanding that like, just like your stories belong to other people and you can't really control it. And they're going to bring their whole, like a whole weight set of assumptions to your stories. Like they will also do that with your authorial persona, that they will also talk to you in part based on things they've imagined. And that's like normal and fine. And sort of what actually Cat Person isn't about, right? Like all of the ways that we think about the people that we're imagining and how that affects how we interact with them. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't count the number of times I've like been so sure when I met an author, they'd be my best friend, you know, and then I meet them and they kind of suck. And it's like, oh, well, you know, you still love the book. It doesn't matter. And so I guess I try to remember that.
After this conversation, I can give you a short list of authors who will be your best friend.
Okay, that would be nice. Yeah. Them, actually.
I'll do that. They are vetted and ready to go.
Yeah, a little black book full of cool people. That would be lovely.
One more question on the subject of Cat Person. Do you consider it to be the most realistic story in your collection? And if not, what superlative might you assign to it?
Oh, yeah. It's certainly, I don't know. I haven't actually tried to like rank them in order. It's certainly like there's a spectrum and it's far along the spectrum of realism, mm-hmm, which who even knows what that word means, like dig down and, you know, you'll get completely lost. But like the stakes are relatively low, right? Like in the sense that no one gets murdered, no one gets turned into a monster.
Right.
The steps, it like lead you fairly. I'm always interested like in moments where like you are identifying with or being pushed out of a character. And I think the story gives you, in a way that I think realist stories tend to, like a lot of steps, like to identify a lot of points where you can identify with Margot and she seems like of this world and like you, as opposed to some of the other stories that drop you really dramatically into like the consciousness of someone who is nothing like you and is also terrifying, you know? And so I think yeah, I would say that one. And like the good guy too, although the good guy, like what happens in the story is realistic, but the story does the opening line pushes you away, right? Like, yeah, I don't think most people are like, oh yeah, I've had that thought, you know? and so it takes a slightly different angle on that, like introducing you into a different consciousness that I think, and like making like sort of the lens of the story clear, like maybe that's like transparent clear, which I think is a realism tactic maybe.
And the initial thought in The Good Guy has to do with knives. There are a lot of knives in this book.
Yeah.
It's a really stabby book.
It's often been called stabby in my time. It's funny putting a collection together, how you see yourself in a new light and your own preoccupations become much clearer than they were, at least than mine were to myself before I did the work of going back over all my stories and putting a book together.
Yeah, and putting them in order, which I do want to talk a little bit about. But first, I read that it was a bit of a fight for you to lead the collection with the story Bad Boy. First, would you tell our listeners a little bit about that story? And then also, would you let me know, what did your editors say about leading with this one?
Sure. So Bad Boy is certainly one of the, if not the most brutal and darkest stories in the collection. And it in a very short number of pages, moves from being the story of a couple who sort of adopt and tend to a friend of theirs who's recently become single, been dumped, and then moves very quickly into a sexual menage a trois, and from there to a four-way involving necrophilia. So it's dark. It's a dark, dark story. And it's not easy to take. And I knew that. And I think I have the history of that story is funny in that I wrote it. I mean, I don't know if funny is the right word, but I wrote it probably 3 or 4 years ago. And when I wrote it, I was like, oh my God, no one can ever see this. This is the same thing I've ever written. Like, what have I done? And then part of my getting my feet under me as a writer has been like this slow process of being like, I'm a very dark writer. I write these weird, pretty explicit things. And like, people either like that or don't. And so like, the Bad Boy has lived that arc with me, and that I then submitted it to like a very niche genre magazine called Body Parts Magazine that I thought nobody would ever read. And it like went online, and I was sort of like, oh my God, I hope that no one ever reads this. And like, I had to send an author photo, and I sent a picture of me from behind of the back of my head, because I like didn't want to identify myself with the story. And then eventually, like, one day I had workshop in my MFA, and I hadn't written a story, and I was like, I wonder what they think of Bad Boy. I submitted it to my MFA workshop. And then as I was putting the collection together, and it in workshop, you know, invited the kind of like very strong and polarizing reactions that, you know, it tends to. Some people loved it, some people hated it. I read it out loud as my like final story when I graduated from my MFA program to like an auditorium full of people. And then it became the first story in my collection. And then it, you know, pissed off the New York Times. And so it truly has been like, it's gone on a real ride. And you asked what my editor thought of it, or what she said. And you know, it's funny, one of the great blessings of Cat Person was that when it went viral, I had already put the collection together. It was with my agent, and she, you know, because it was, you know, had the reaction that it did, when the collection went out, it went to auction, and a lot of people bid on it. And so I had conversations with what now seemed to me like all of the most brilliant editors in New York City. And it was incredible. Yeah. It was also exhausting. And like, I was terrified of making the wrong choice, but I got sort of like the collective wisdom of everybody, which was amazing. And it was divisive in that some people, and it was probably, maybe it was split half and half. Maybe it was like a little bit weighted towards, like, maybe move that story, but like it was split. And it was like either, and there were two sort of theories that were like, that I think both were legitimate. One was like, you got, every book teaches its readers how to read it. And if you open with Bad Boy, which is extreme and hard sort of to read and wrap your mind around, like it's a very simple story, but like it's a tough, it's like hard to swallow. If you open you're going to put off readers that if you had started with Cat Person and sort of like coaxed them along, by the time they got to Bad Boy, they would be ready for that. And I do think like there is a book that is good that works in that way. But the other ones, and the, I ended up choosing an editor, her name's Allison Callahan, who felt this way and said it, is like, the book is what it is. And it's fair, it respects the readers more to announce its intentions from the beginning and to say sort of, you're in or you're out. This is not, you know, this isn't Cat Person, but also like, this isn't the book you might be expecting. And it also might not be the book that you're wanting. And like, for me, I don't know, like I feel deeply invested in that, like that you don't need to, I didn't want to like trick readers into buying a book that would turn out to be something that they loathed, that like, especially because, and this is like, then becomes like, I don't know, like a little fuzzier, but like, because so many people who loved Cat Person loved it for such personal reasons. Like, I just hated the idea of like somebody wanting something more like Cat Person and then just finding themselves reading Bad Boy, like after they'd already bought the book. Like, I just, that felt like it was cheating. And so I put the Bad Boy in the front, and I've actually been like really impressed by like how many readers of Cat Person were able to like and willing to make the leap into Bad Boy. But I think the book, I mean, it's an accurate, it's maybe the most extreme, but it's also an accurate representation. It's a fair faced to like sort of aim at the world in terms of what else is inside. And I do feel good about that decision, even though I know it may have lost me some readers that I could have gotten if I had structured the book in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is Bad Boy is more extreme, but you're right in that it does sort of exemplify the other stories. And for me, like in the sense that, you know, a lot of your stories sort of go to what a reader thinks is going to be the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of go beyond that edge, which I respect. I really like that about this book. But it must be kind of fun to go a little beyond the edge, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing about Bad Boy and another thing about almost all of the stories in it, that you either kind of think it's fun and a little bit funny or you don't. And if you don't, I do not think you can get through this book. Do you know what I mean? Like, and people, when they were taught Cat Person, it goes either way. I think there are people who could read Cat Person and didn't see any humor in it and still loved it and found it sort of meaningful to them. I think Cat Person is dark and like is trying to say some important things, but it's also at times funny. And I mean that, you know, like, I think I can say that without undermining all of the other things I want the story to do. But I think the collection as a whole, you have to get the humor or how else will you like get through the book?
It's
happened to so many people, and that's just like, I mean, that's another thing you can't argue with readers who are like, I don't want this money. It's like, fair enough, you know.
I think it probably has a little bit to do with where you are in terms of your relationship to the patriarchy. You know, like it can get to a funny place, you know.
And like the darkness, like there's often a moment where like suddenly it snaps and the things that seem so dark suddenly seem funny, you know, like I find that in my own life too. And yeah, it's like can be the same person on two different days, like where you see it's absurd and it's funny or it's deadly serious. And that's an interesting place to work in. But like, you know, it's delicate as a writer.
Yeah. Well, the humor you're talking about was one of the most pleasurable things about reading beyond Cat Person for me, that the book is quite funny. And in the reaction, at least, to Cat Person, because Cat Person engendered all of these, you know, as you said, all these very serious articles. But the book is so funny. So congrats on that.
Thank you. It means a lot to me. And it does, like, I was saying to someone, like, I was working on a screenplay recently with a friend of mine, and I was talking about how, like, one of the reasons I can work with her is that she gets that there's a point when you're writing something terrible where you just kind of start to cackle and you just feel evil and alone and you sort of hope that other people will like cackle with you. But you never know, right? Like you're always like, this could be the moment where I have gone too far and I am the only person in the world who thinks that this darkness is funny.
Yeah, that's when you end up saying creep in a tiki bar karaoke lounge at like 1 a.m.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
As Megan knows well.
Well, not to get too personal, but I really wanted to ask you, professionally speaking, after having grabbed this big brass ring, what is your heart's desire?
Oh, man. Like right now, my heart's desire is, this has been a very fun conversation, but my heart's desire is to stop talking about get away from like the crazed like whirlwind of, you know, having a book come out next month. I've had this, and I do think like in terms of, you know, I did grab the brass ring and specifically I grabbed the freedom to be writing and only writing for like a significant amount of time. And like every once in a while when I start to feel overwhelmed, I remember about how at this time a year and 2 months ago, I had no idea how I was going to do that even for like another year. And now it's spreading out ahead of me. So I'm excited for that. I also, though, I think there will be a long time where I'm just reading books and I probably, and I like need to like refill a well. And I thought, I had the idea today. I've always really wanted to, do you know, there's this like program at Middlebury called the Summer Language Institute, where you like go there and you sign a contract that you won't speak English again. And like you learn a foreign language just by like pure immersion in 2 months. I've always wanted to do that. And I don't speak French, and I've always wanted to learn French. And I've been daydreaming about that. I think because it's like, I've just been talking and talking and talking and talking, and it would just be so fun to be like, you can't, till you learn French, you can't talk again. Oh.
C'est magnifique, bonne chance.
Or something, I don't know. I don't know, just daydreaming a lot about just like taking in as opposed to sort of putting out, because I've been in a phase of like putting out and talking and having opinions on things for the past year, and it's been great. I mean, it's been a ride, but it's been hard. So yeah, that's my dream.
So what are, can you tell us what the novel's about, or do you not talk about ideas before they're out in the world?
I try not to, just because if I do talk about them too early, they lose a certain, like, I have to get myself into a headspace, this connects to what I was just saying, when I'm writing, like, where I pretend that no one will ever read it, and it's right. Just, like, a secret thing I'm doing for fun. And when I can get there, I can get really weird and kind of, fit, you know, not unselfconscious. And the moment I start being like, here I'm like telling people that I'm trying to do something, I freeze up, and it's like, I'm thinking too much about it and I can't do it. Yeah. I'm also working on and always working on multiple projects. So I could tell you, and it could turn out to be totally wrong. So
true. I can respect that.
Yeah.
Okay. Party people. Is this it? I think we're cruising right to time. I was like, that was my, my ultimate question. You know, the heart's desire. So, I mean, I could.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good ending. I mean, it's funny because there's a story, right, about heart's desire in there, maybe making a more knowing joke than I caught on because I'm shy.
Noticing.
My heart's desire is to keep a man in my basement and torture him with knives until all my dreams come true. So, and some of my deepest, my cruelest critics probably already suspected that's my dream. But this has been really fun. I've really enjoyed it. So, and I am so grateful for the review and just for like the good questions. So
I am grateful to you for this conversation and for the experience of reading this truly memorable book. So thank you very much for both.
All right. You're very welcome.
Well, thank you, Kristen. The book is You Know You Want This. The writer is Kristen Rupinian, and it's out now. So thanks for spending some time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, she was talking about the debate at her publishing house about whether she should start this collection with Bad Boy. I thought it was a great idea because there's a lot of bravado in that story, and it does let you know what you're in for.
Yeah, it will certainly arouse your interest, intentional word choice, and before it takes you somewhere darker than that. Yeah. So, I mean, kudos to her and congratulations for the tremendous success. I'm rooting for her.
Yeah. No, and it'll be really exciting to see what, you know, to see her work in the longer form of a novel, you know, really draw her ideas out. So that'll be great to see. We will definitely be looking for that novel at Kirkus Reviews. So now let's call up our editors and see which books that are out this week they think are actually worth your time.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks in books this week. We have children's editor Vicky Smith, YA editor Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Machnick. Vicky, what have you got for us?
I have Max and the Midnights by Lincoln Purse, and Midnights is spelled MIDKNIGHTS. And folks probably know Lincoln Purse from the Big Nate comic strip and the Big Nate novels that mixed sort of comic book panels along with stretches of prose. And this is his first non-Big Nate endeavor. And it takes place in the Kingdom of Bijovia, which is a sort of fake Europe kingdom in the tradition of a lot of kids' fantasy. And Max lives with Uncle Budrick, who is a terrible troubadour. And according to the custom of Bijovia, Max is also destined to become a troubadour, but Max absolutely does not want to be a troubadour. Max wants to become a knight. Medieval mishap, that's the phrase that the reviewer used, ensues. There is an evil usurping king. There is a bunch of kids who are the midknights of the title. And there's a evil sorceress and zombies. So lots of stuff is happening. Like Big Nate, it's told in a combination of comic strips and prose. But I shouldn't say but, because Big Nate did a lot of kind of subtle stuff underneath all the fun. And one of the things that Max and the Midknights does is it really tackles gender roles, gender expectations, and gender nonconformity in this very fizzy, fun package. So,
I noticed, Vicky, that in the review, we don't use any pronouns referring to Max. Was that just the way it happened, you know, as the writer was writing the review? Or do you think that's something more purposeful?
It's definitely purposeful.
Are there pronouns in the book?
To be honest, I cannot remember what the book does in terms of pronouns. A lot of the story is the comic strip dialogue bubbles, as well as prose. And so dialogue bubbles, you know, typically don't have pronouns at all. But it's part of the sort of inquiry into gender roles and gender expectations. That's one of the reasons that we are very consciously not using pronouns in our review, is because it's part of the way that Peirce is approaching how we construct gender and how we might need to reevaluate it as we discover more about the person, you know, the main character. So,
sounds intriguing.
Yeah.
So, Laura, what is going on in young adult books?
So there's a new release from Elizabeth Wien. It's called A Thousand Sisters, the Heroic Airwomen of the Soviet Union in World War II. And, of course, Wien is known for her fiction, you know, codenamed Verity and so on. But she is branching out into nonfiction, and she brings her storytelling flair, you know, with her. And this book is just, it's fantastic. It's meticulously researched, but there's a lot of human interest details and this great balance between the big picture, you know, the Romanovs and the Bolsheviks and World War II, but which, you know, will help people who aren't really familiar with those topics, but then focusing on just how incredible it was. The Soviets were the only country in the world to have women combat pilots during World War II. And it's interesting. So, disclaimer, she doesn't gloss over any of the nasty bits when it comes to Stalin, but she gives this great perspective on how, you know, part of the whole revolution was gender equity. And so in the US, while kids were segregated, you know, into shop or home ec, boys and girls in the Soviet Union, side by side as part of the school curriculum, were learning to shoot rifles. And so even, you know, going back to World War One, there were actually women troops fighting alongside men. And there's this great story she relates towards the beginning about Maria Butchkareva, who she rescued 50 soldiers single-handedly. She was made a commander, but she kind of felt that the men in her unit, they didn't have like the zest that she was hoping for. So she got permission from Tsar Nicholas II, and she established the Women's Battalion of Death, which I just think is the most brilliant name, you know, like no messing around there, you know what they're about. But this book, it's great. She focuses on, you know, particularly Maria Raskova, who was this Soviet heroine for setting a world record in flight, and she and all the young women that she mentored, and just the tremendous sacrifices they made. You know, it was physically dangerous. It was freezing cold. They wore face masks made out of mole fur. But then also on a personal level, you know, there's a lot of talk of gender equality, but many of these women had small children, and a lot of the basics, like reliable childcare, they had to cope with while they were flying these dangerous missions. So it's a really absorbing book. Highly recommend it.
I was so excited, Laura, when I saw that this book exists in the world, because I love Elizabeth Wien's work. And I particularly love the way that she writes about aviation. This may be her first nonfiction book, but a lot of her fiction has involved flight in some way, and women flyers in particular. And you know, I just remember reading one of the opening scenes in Codename Verity, and it was so beautiful, I started crying, just the way it described the main character flying over the English countryside just before the war began. And so I am so incredibly excited to see this book, and thank you very much for telling us about it.
You won't be disappointed.
Turning now to nonfiction, Eric, what have you chosen?
So my recommendation this week is the new book by Susan Orlean called The Library Book.
Yes.
Susan Orlean, from her writing for The New Yorker and her best-selling book, The Orchid Thief. She's written a few other books. Those are probably her best known. But this new one is about an event that I actually wasn't aware of. In 1986, in April, the Los Angeles Public Library caught on fire. And it burned for more than 7 hours, and more than 1 million books were burned or damaged. So she goes through the story of that, and there's a little like mystery involved. A troubled young man who was an actor named Harry Peake, who may have started the fire, but we're not really sure. You don't really learn what actually happened, but it's a very good mix. She mixes in a little bit of history of book burning in, you know, during World War II, the Nazis destroyed more than 100 million books. And it's just a very, any person who is a book geek, like most of the people listening to this podcast, I'm sure are, is going to love this book. I mean, as usual, it's just so readable easily. It's kind of casual, but engaging. It's just you'll devour it. Highly recommended book for anybody, any bibliophile. Would love this book.
The day after Christmas, I saw a tweet, and it was a picture of three copies of the library book. Apparently, all of the adult children of a librarian had picked this as the gift for their mom. And the fourth child, kind of like the black sheep straggler, their copy was still in the mail. It didn't arrive on time. So, but a preferred gift for the bookish.
1 year for Christmas, I got 4 Nancy Pearl action figures.
Well, Eric, nobody gave me this book for Christmas. I feel really, really sad about that, but I can't wait to read it. And I think, you know, you nailed it with Susan Orlean. It's like, I don't have a particular interest in orchids or Rin Tin Tin, but I loved those books. I feel like she can make anything interesting.
Yeah.
And, highly recommend My Kind of Place. It's a collection of her travel essays, and I love travel literature, but it's great. But I also wanted to recommend Mary Roach, because I feel like Mary Roach has the same gift where she writes nonfiction on so many different topics, and a lot of them I pick up because she wrote them, not because the topic itself interests me, because I know she'll do such a good job.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison. Those two writers are, like, you definitely hit it on the head as you pick it up because of the writer, not necessarily the subject. Good point.
So, Laurie, what are we liking in fiction?
I would like to recommend a book that is just coming out. It's called Big Bang by David Bowman. This is a name that might be familiar to people who've been following literary fiction for a very long time. David Bowman came out with his first novel, Let the Dog Drive, in 1992. It was from like NYU Press, and, you know, very, not a big press or anything, but it got tons of buzz, and it was very, it was kind of a very wacky, unusual book. And then he published in 98 a book called Bunny Modern, and this is his next book. He hasn't published a book since then. Of course, part of the reason is that he passed away in 2012. But even, you know, from 98 when Bunny Modern came out till 2012, that was a long time. You know, he kind of, nobody knew what happened to him. He sort of disappeared after making a bit of a big splash. And now this And those two were both kind of fairly thin, antic books. And this is like Big Bang is a big 500 and something page book about the Kennedy assassination, or not so much the Kennedy assassination, but about like the whole world of U.S. history and culture leading up to the assassination and afterwards, the sort of Don DeLillo-esque book, totally different from what you would have expected from him. Mm-hmm. Apparently, he was very good friends with Jonathan Lethem, who's written a quite a long introduction talking about Bowman's life, which is really interesting and also, as you would expect, well written. So mm-hmm. the whole package is very interesting for, you know, people who like deep dives into, you know, engrossing, absorbing literary fiction about just the whole, that try to encapsulate the culture as a whole. But like all kinds of weird things happen that don't really happen in the world. Like Camus has an affair with Maria Callas. JFK gets together with Aristotle Onassis to commiserate over the Kennedy stillborn child, like all kinds of things. There are all sorts of celebrities and just lots of stuff, in, you know, pushed into this novel. So mm-hmm. it's very interesting.
That sounds right up my alley. It's, you're talking about life. David Bowman is, like you said, the name that's kind of been ricocheting around. I had never read any of his work. And I was reading this review, I was thinking, oh, this is like very Don DeLillo-esque. And then, of course, near the end, the reviewer mentions it. It seems like any DeLillo fan or similar writers would love this book.
Yeah, absolutely. He also, I think Norman Mailer is a character in the book. He seems to definitely be an influence.
Right.
Well, thank you all. Those are some great choices. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Pam Houston. You might know her from her story collection, Cowboys Are My Weakness, which is a contemporary classic. She has a more recent collection of essays, Contents May Have Shifted. And her new one, just out, is titled Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. And it's a collection of essays about finding and maintaining one's place on our changing planet. So until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.